Hello and welcome to the Health Hacks Podcast, the podcast for high-performing professional females looking for practical ways to optimize all areas of their health and wellness. At Health Hacks, we understand that as a busy female, you wear numerous hats throughout your working week. You're trying to juggle it all, while also looking to carve out time to prioritize your own goals. It's challenging. It's therefore our mission to channel your energy into the areas that are going to help give you the biggest bang for your buck, to really make significant changes to your lifestyle in the most efficient way possible. So at the moment, if you feel as though you need more energy, you want to feel more productive to improve the quality of your sleep, to lower stress, to increase confidence, to show up better in both your personal and your professional relationships, this podcast is for you. If it's time you prioritize your health, learn to fuel your body, found time for exercise, and said goodbye to fad diets and inconsistent behaviors for good, this podcast is for you. If it's time for you to step into the shoes of the high performer you know you can be, this is the right podcast for you. Join me and my guests as we take you through the Health Hacks Podcast. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Health Hacks Podcast. This week I'm talking all things stress management with coach and public speaker Bernadette Dancy. On this episode of the podcast, expect to learn, why are some people simply better at dealing with stress than others? How can we support stress management in our working environments? And how can our leaders, you may be a leader yourself, help support your team to avoid burnout? And last but not least, we've been talking a lot about fitness trackers over the last few episodes of Health Hacks. How can you measure your stress? What are the metrics that Bernadette advises her clients use to measure and manage their stress? As ever, thank you so much for joining me on the platform. Thrilled to have you if you are a longtime listener. Special welcome if it's your first time. If you would love to show support for the show, I would greatly appreciate it. It allows us to spread our message. It allows me to have amazing guests like Bernadette on the show. If you would love to show your support, there are two ways that you can do so. The first one is to hit the follow or subscribe button. You're probably listening to me on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Just hit that follower subscribe, scroll down, and we will magically appear in your podcast inbox every single week. You'll never have to search for the platform again, and hopefully we'll be covering topics every single week that you are incredibly interested in and you want to find out about our new content. Otherwise, perhaps there's someone in your life who you know is trying to make a positive change to their health, well-being. Potentially they're going through a really stressful time at the moment. Send them the platform, send them this episode of the podcast, and we can spread our message as far and wide as possible and add as much value as we can. At last count, Health Hacks has spread to 26 countries globally, and I'd love that number to continue to climb. And last but not least, if you are looking to make a health and well-being change this year, we're coming to the end of Q1 in 2024, which is terrifying. So hopefully through the hibernation period of winter and coming into the sunnier, warmer spring and summer months, if you had all the best intentions of making a change this year, but the first quarter hasn't gone quite as you planned, but now is your time. Get in touch. My contact details are in the show notes below. If you're interested or want to find out more about one-to-one coaching services or working with me personally, perhaps our message over at the Health Hacks Podcast has really resonated with you and you want to find out more about what we do with our one-to-one clients, get in touch. I'd love to hear from you. Okay, that's more than enough for me for this week. Let's get into this episode with Bernadette Dancy. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Health Hacks Podcast. I'm so pleased today to be joined by Bernadette Dancy. Bernadette is a stress management coach with more than 15 years experience studying the science and psychology of human health and potential. She's on a mission to help people harness stress. And she joins us today. Bernadette, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you, Caroline?
Wonderful. Thank you so much for your time today. And we're going to be talking about one of the biggest barriers that ladies do come to, both you and I,
surrounding. But before we get into the topic of stress today, which is going to be the backbone, the theme that we're going to dive into, can you tell us a little bit about your background and really why you've chosen to specialize in this area and why it really called out to you as a as an area to devote yourself to?
Yeah, it really is a devotion, and it's a passion really, but it goes quite way back. I won't give you my life story, but in short, I started my career as a university lecturer. So my PhD was in sports psychology, but my undergraduate degree was the combination of human biology and sports science. So I was really fascinated, always been interested in that body-mind connection. Couldn't quite choose, whether to go down the biology route. Loved the nuances, the detail, the how we manage and balance the body. But fascinated by how, as human beings, we have these kind of glitches, how the mind can play tricks and how it can impact our health, how it overrides all of that very clever biology and physiology. So after my degree, I was invited to do a PhD in sports psychology, which was in stress in elite performers, specifically elite football players, actually. We were looking at the idea of how is it that some people can perform well under stress, under pressure, and others can't, which was right up my street. So we were looking at that kind of body-mind connection. And then off the back of that, my own dad unfortunately passed away very young at 47. He had a cardiac arrest, and it was around that time in my PhD. I was 24, and that was a really difficult experience, life experience, but made worse potentially by me, if that could be worse. But I was there when it happened and gave him CPR, but he didn't make it. And that was beyond traumatic, harrowing, overwhelming, but also infuriating to me because I couldn't understand how, previous that a year before he'd had a check and they told him everything was fine, for a man of your age, you're, bit of cholesterol, a bit of blood pressure, do a bit of exercise, you'll be fine. And there he was a year later, with a sudden cardiac arrest. And that to me changed my pathway. It changed my thinking around how I wanted to work. I love elite performance. I love power of the mind and harnessing that for performance, but I really wanted to understand or help contribute towards health. So my master's took me down I did a master's in lifestyle medicine, and then basically spent 15 years teaching undergrad students. I wrote a degree called clinical exercise science, and we were looking at health and exercise to teach people how to harness their stress. I ran a healthy lifestyle clinic at the university where we were taking patients from GP practices into the university so the students could see people in the real world, right? It wasn't just case studies on paper. And I ran that for about a year, but like most people, I then burnt out. I had two young kids who didn't like to sleep very much. Being a kind of go-getter, high achiever, never stopped type person, it came back and it bit me on the arse. I was trying to run ultra marathons, had kids, I was trying to do it all. So for me, that I had to take a break and I had to reassess, and that became my next kind of understanding. My journey was, again, how do I understand this? What can I learn from it? And because I was running the clinic, I decided to do that for myself. I was like, the industry of academia is very difficult when you've got a young family. And I thought, well, what I'm doing there is something I can do. And I set up a business and I haven't looked back. So the last 7 years, I've specialized in helping people to utilize stress in a positive way and understand it, because we all have to live with it, even me, right? So that's my kind of whistle stop journey, really.
And I can't think of anyone better placed from all these life experiences. I'm sorry to hear that's obviously been some traumatic experiences that have happened to you, but I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I would guess that you feel very armed to help a lot of these women, having lived through and experienced a lot of those stressors yourself.
Yeah, unfortunately, but also fortunately, I think I wouldn't, looking back, of course, we don't want to lose people, but I think it's kind of made me the individual I am. It's become a purpose. I understand why it happened to him, but also there is a huge connection between stress and what happened with him. And I understand that at a level where when I talk to, men of his age now, and I'm very close to his age now, right? And as I get close to his age, I realize really how young he was at the time. I'm 24. Of course, I knew he was young, but as I approach his age, I kind of think that shouldn't happen. And so it's a real passion that when I go and talk at corporate level or talk to individuals, and especially men, I think at times, is to have that connection to the impact stress really has. Like, I mean, really has. We know it's emotionally difficult, but we forget that we're literally talking about the impact on our life. And that just not just for my own father, but then for my mom to be a widow. You know, I'm one of seven children. The youngest was only nine. So the fallout and the impact on the whole family was huge. And the stress then that bled out into the family and again into my own life with my own young children. So I think being the type of person I am, that thirst for knowledge, that academic mindset, I've basically spent 7 years wanting to understand it, studying it to the nth degree, and I continue to do that. I don't ever feel like I've harnessed it. There's so much research, so much to learn.
Yeah. We'll go into that research and where we are going in terms of the literature and the studies that are being done on this, because I think more so than ever before, I think the two things that keep coming out in a lot of the professionals that we speak to is sleep and stress are these kind of underliers that haven't been given the same prominence in the well-being spaces as nutrition and exercise. And they're now actually coming to the forefront of all of these discussions, which is fantastic to see. It really, really is. Bernadette, I need to ask you two questions. Why do some people simply cope better with stress than others? And I realize you've done a whole, you've probably spent years studying that specific question.
Yes.
Is there any, you know, themes around why some people are just better at coping with it? And I mean, I'm not a massive football fan myself, but I've watched those penalty shootouts where you see that everyone line up ready to take it. And some of them seem to crack, some of them seem to thrive under that pressure. Why does it happen?
I mean, we're looking at, yeah, so there's two different components to it. So from an acute stress point of view, in those acutely stressed situations where we all have to maybe face with challenges, that can come down, that can be a learned skill. So there's preparation that goes into that, right? So there are skills that we can learn to harness that in the moment. And as a performance psychologist, there are things that you can teach people. Now, the thing is, the body's got different ideas. It's our ability to tolerate that sensation, to have strength of mind, to be able to overcome intrusive thoughts. So it is a real skill. Some people are more adept at it, and it could be a personality trait. It will be based on their past experiences, their life story, right? So it's harder to maybe go back against those negative thought patterns if they've had a difficult, challenging time, or they're really, you know, thinking of failures or situations that hasn't gone so well. So it's really individual. So in an acute sense, we can work on skill sets and help people to harness it. But if you think about life stress more broadly, and we look at chronic stress, why is it that perhaps some people suffer with chronic stress over others? Again, it's so individual, but there are common kind of things that come up in the coaching that I do and I see of people. And I would say we have to remember that life story is a huge component of that, much like it is in mine, right? I would have considered myself relatively resilient, you know, fit, healthy, didn't drink, slept quite well until I had kids, you know, running ultra marathons, ate really well, you know, was a qualified personal trainer, was doing all these things. And there I was, burnt out and broken. So you could say, well, why does that happen? But if we look at that's on the back of trauma, that's a back of a life story. You have to look into that. We have to consider individual stories. And it's not because of any fault of their own. Sometimes chronic stress happens, and there are certain individuals who are more inclined for that. Okay, so we've got individual differences. Female, people who are neurodivergent. We look at intersectionality. We've got gay and lesbian community. We've got people who are non-Caucasian, so Asian, Black community. They are all people with a lower socioeconomic status. They are more likely to experience stress, not because of any failing of their own. So if you ask them the question, simply which are more likely to experience than not, it's really, really difficult to say. Then we're looking, how do we cope with it? I would say it's then helping people to understand that, understand why that's happening to them. And then we can help them to harness it better by teaching them the skills to overcome that.
Yeah. So even if you are someone who, I just want to take a positive view on things, even if you are someone who has experienced trauma, it's very, very deep rooted, it's not the case necessarily that you will always be someone who responds negatively to stress. Is that correct? There are things that we can do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I try and champion that, you know, with the work that I do with my clients and when I give, you know, when I do public speaking. And it's not to come across as being arrogant. It's kind of going, look, you know, I really want you to see that this is possible, you know, that I'm really behind them. Like, come on, you can do this. Because I know, because I've come through some dark times and I feel that sometimes we get lost in that, that with that trauma, that they're stuck in this stress cycle. So it absolutely is with whether it's therapy or coaching, there are strategies that we can rewire the brain. Remember, the brain is neuroplastic, but we do need that support and help. I didn't do it on my own. I got lots of support and help, but I had to do a lot of work 7 years ago versus what we've got now. So I like to think that you, the work that you do, the work that I do, the work that we're doing now, it can expedite that process for people. So if you find the right person, you don't have to do all that research. So there absolutely is ways that we can help people. And that's why I call it harnessing stress. You know, it's we can bring back control and we can live with it, but it doesn't have to override our system.
Yeah. I'll ask the question then, what are the impacts of that stress on us? We can talk about this physically, we can talk about it psychologically, but what is actually happening to us when stress rises in the body?
So let's talk about chronic stress. So let's say somebody, because it's quite often the case when people get to us, by the time they've come to us, they've lived with stress for quite a long time. And we would consider chronic stress anything for that's lasted about maybe 6 months or more, where symptoms haven't reduced. And there is a body and mind shift. So from an emotional or psychological point of view, when someone's chronically stressed, the part of the brain that is more rational or logical, so the more developed part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, to use a cliched word we hear in the wellness industry all the time, it's offline. Okay, well, what does that mean? It doesn't mean that you're never there, but we are more inclined to have a dominance in the amygdala, so the less kind of developed part of our mind, the emotional center. And the amygdala's job is to basically to look for threat and danger. So if somebody's chronically stressed, what we know is that that part of the brain, the amygdala, in the limbic system, is a bit like a radar in a submarine, right? It's blipping, it's looking for threats and threats to safety, threats to our nervous system all of the time. So from a psychological point of view, it can mean that we're more predetermined to negative thinking. We're more predetermined to catastrophizing, to be worried, to see that things always happen this way. You know, we're looking to protect ourselves. And that's exhausting, because once that kicks in, well, then we're in that negative loop of thinking, but it also trickles down into the body. So that then talks to the body, and the body will activate the nervous system. So without anything happening in our lives, simply by us having this pathway of negative thinking or of high alert thinking, of lack of safety, we're switching on the body's stress response perpetually, and it never gets time to turn off. And that's what then, if you look at what happens in the body, the chronic stress response starts to give physical symptoms. The stress response is designed to come and go, right? So we have acute stressor, stress response kicks in, stress goes away, we go back to something called homeostasis, the body's happy. But in chronic stress, people who are always activated, which is most of us, let's be honest, the stress response doesn't switch off, which means we see changes in the adrenal system, in the adrenal gland, in the endocrine system, in the central nervous system, within the immune system, the digestive system, the cardiovascular system. And we start to see changes and we start to get symptoms. And these symptoms are often what people start to worry about, because I think what I've seen is people can live with psychological stress for a long time. It's when the symptom, physical symptoms show up, they're a bit like, oh, what's going on there? What's going on with that? And they're knackered and they're tired. And by the time people are there, they've been suffering for much longer than they think.
What are those physical symptoms? You're going to run, or you will present them, I'm sure, and people will be able to say, oh yeah, that's me. That's me.
Yeah.
Me, that's me. Are there any ones, I'll be more specific then, any physical symptoms of stress that we should be looking at, the slightly earlier ones, the ones that are slightly easier to push aside and be like, oh no, it's just because I'm a little bit tired, or you know, you just don't think about them. Are there any of those early warning signs that we should be a little bit more cognizant of?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I think that's the key. Let's not look for red flags, let's look for amber flags, right? If we look back and we go back through and we look at amber flags, and I talk to clients, you know, you look at their history and we look at what's been going on, they'll say things like, but I always get ill when I go on holiday. Isn't that annoying? And I'll go, no, but it's not a coincidence. And the reason we get ill when we go on holiday is it's usually not to do with the holiday. But if you think about it, it's because we've been chronically stressed for a deadline, right? We'll be working towards something. There's a deadline. I'll just get all of this done before I go away. I'll just get all of this done before Christmas. So we're squeezing as much as we can. So when we go away, we're not leaving stuff left undone for people, for the people. We want to close that door. Well, we usually sacrifice our health in that time. We're under significant demand, lack of sleep. Maybe we're overusing caffeine. Maybe we're using alcohol. We're going to be pushing, right? And chronic stress affects our immune system. So the immune system will become suppressed. So if your immune system's suppressed and then you go on a holiday, you're traveling, you're around new germs, new bugs, new people, you're on a plane, whatever, and then we get ill. And that's where I would say to people, start thinking about that. Start thinking about these patterns, because that's a really good warning sign that you're putting yourself under excessive demand. Other respiratory illnesses like sinusitis, especially if it's ongoing. So one question I always ask people is, do you suffer with respiratory illnesses? So repeated chest infections, repeated bouts of sinusitis. It's a good indication that there's something going on, that their immune system may be suppressed. Ongoing gut health problems, again, we ignore them, we live with them, we tolerate them. Another one that women we overlook is sex drive, so our libido, right? So if that starts to go offline and we notice, okay, when we're tired, that can happen a lot. But if we're consistently there, that's something to think about, what's going on, and checking in with our hormones and things like that. So it's important that we start to pay attention to the things that we brush under the carpet. I'm just tired. We're not maybe just tired. Maybe there's something else going on.
In terms of, I want to just ask you about one thing that I've been asked a couple of times, and I think it would be good to speak about it audience-wide, because we hear a lot of conversations increasingly around stress, which is great. But could you maybe clarify for us the difference between, we'll hear things like adrenaline and cortisol and the role that they play in the body. Could you maybe explain the difference between those two and what they're actually doing, or the similarities between those two in the body?
So they play a really important role, and we can demonize them. So this is the first thing I want to say, is cortisol gets a bad rep, but actually cortisol is great and we need it. So what we think about is both of them are really just fundamental parts of a system that's trying to help us regulate. So what's the body's primary focus? It's to maintain balance. And another scientific word for that is homeostasis. And the body is so adept at doing this that we don't even know what's happening in the background. And it's happening all the time. It will regulate our breathing. It will regulate our body temperature by making us shiver. It will regulate our heart rate. It will regulate our lots of different things, our hormones. Okay, so the body does this in the background. And it's the same with the stress response. So we receive information into the body about threat, risk, harm, or even challenge. So positive stress, okay? If that's, there's nuance around that, but positive stress. And that information goes into the brain. Now, half the time, we're not even privy to that information. So we receive information through the senses without even consciously being aware that the brain is picking up threat to the system. So it could be a smell, it could be a sound, it could be just a sense of looking at someone's face that they don't look safe, or they look, and we, the body has already started to release chemicals before we realized it in response to that. So the first thing that happens is the sympathetic nervous system will release adrenaline and noradrenaline. And adrenaline and noradrenaline are neurotransmitters at that point, okay? So they will be released really, really quickly into the nervous system, from the nervous system, sorry, into the nerve endings at the end of our limbs, etc. And the idea behind that is it will help us within milliseconds to respond to whatever's happening. So it tells us to move away from danger, or it will help us to breathe faster. It will help us to increase our heart rate, increase our breath rate. So it's brilliant. We need it. If you go to cross the road and somebody beeps the horn, you want adrenaline.
Yeah.
You need that, right? So it's milliseconds. And then the system's so advanced that it recognizes if that danger continues or persists beyond milliseconds to minutes and even onto hours, the secondary system kicks in within the nervous system. And that's the endocrine system. And the endocrine system, looking specifically within that, the adrenal glands release a hormone, a glucocorticoid called cortisol. And cortisol, its main role is to activate energy into our body. So it's simply there to go, there's a threat, there's harm, there's challenge. This person needs energy. So it releases cortisol and it tells the body, cortisol communicates to stored glycogen in the body. So within the liver, it says, oi, release that energy. Energy is released. We need it instantly to get away from whatever's going on. But if the message isn't being, oh, the safety's gone, or the threat to safety's gone, and we're now fine, cortisol can be perpetually released, or it's never quite coming back to normal. We should release lots of cortisol at the start of the day to wake us up, to get us going. Cortisol should fall throughout the day, and it should be at its lowest before bedtime. We need it. But when you're chronically stressed, that can flatline, it can be very stable, or it can even rise before bedtime. So cortisol and adrenaline simply serve as a very important role within the stress response. The problem is us, society, individuals, how we live, that we are asking the body to constantly deliver those to the system. And we need to help that. We need to give them a bit of a break, really.
You're one step ahead of me then, society. What are the big problems that we are facing as a society? I mean, we'll touch on burnout in just a second, but it's almost becoming quite a colloquial term and really quite normal and offhand to say, you know, someone was off, you know, they're feeling a bit burnt out or they're off with exhaustion. And it might be from ladies I've been in dialogue with, it's maybe a couple of weeks, maybe 2 to 3 weeks, and they're expected to take time off, sleep a bit, feel a little bit better, and then come right back into the roller coaster or the rat race. It seems to be just something that we accept, that we just deal with, forget about, and then get right back into things. But where is this coming from? Why is this a normal conversation in society? What are the issues around this? Do you feel or do you see?
Oh, Caroline, I think you're spot on. And I think this is a conversation we need to be having. So if I do a talk at an organization and they ask me that question, what can we do? They're the people that you want to work for. They're the organizations you need to be working for, because, you know, strategies help. Okay, we can put a budget in to help people to manage stress, but from a cultural level, from a societal level, within the organization, what do we need to change at the top? It has to be a top-down conversation, because you're right, women are men, but mostly women. I will struggle a lot of the time. I never tell my clients to leave or take time off work, but they are so resistant. They are broken. And they're like, but I can't, but I can't, but I can't. And then when they do, they're saying, I can only take a week off and then I'll be fixed, won't I? And I'm like, no. And I think what needs to happen is we need to have a healthy respect for achievement. We're using people like we use single-use plastic within organizations. And I see that in academia, but I see it across the business of finance. I see it across all organizations. There's no one. Education is the same. The health service is the same. You know, private, public, whatever. It's all the same. And the thinking behind it is it's a hustle capitalistic society where we are trying to get the most out of people, because performance is key. Now, I am a hype. I love performing well. I try to achieve my goals. I strive. I've never got my eye off something. Right. I'm always looking at the next challenge. But within organizations, they will push people to burn out, squeeze it out of them. Now, that's either indirect communication or it's how they perceive the culture within that. Or they are achieving, they're seeking out those individuals because they're great people to work for you. Who doesn't want a high achiever who will work late, who will work all hours, who goes, goes, goes? Nothing wrong with it, because that's me. And that's probably you, right? But the problem within the organization is those people break. They might take 2 weeks off. They might come back. They might leave. But somebody else will come in and take that job. Somebody else will want your job. So there's pressure. We don't have a healthy respect for how do we consistently maintain performance without breaking people. So we need a culture shift within organizations. We need to look at other organizations where high performance is optimal, is a high performance and optimal performance is key. And they do not allow their individuals, their employees to break, to burn out to that level. Where do we see that? There's only one place I know, elite sport. Because in elite sport, they're expected to perform optimally. It's big money. They are treated like kings and queens. Now, at the top level, the money that's put into marginal gains, we call it, their sleep, their nutrition, you know, they're walking around wearing light glasses. There's nothing, no stone left unturned. Because if they underperform what we call overtraining, which is synonymous with burnout, the money doesn't come in, but they have a healthy respect for it. And I think within society, we have to, I say that the answer is hidden in plain sight. We just don't want to see it. And if you look to those things, there's 40, 50 years worth of research to support how do we help people not overtrain and not burn out in sport. And we take that approach. And it has to come to a cultural top-down approach where we invest in the individual and not just go, well, you've burned out, we'll get the next one, we'll get the next one.
I think when you were, I've never thought about that, kind of thinking about people as disposable, just bring the next one in, but that's so true, isn't it? And do you know what? I would never wish to make complete blanket statements, but what seems to be a trend is those individuals who have climbed to the top of the ladder, so to speak, you have to be ambitious, you have to be driven, you have to be a certain personality type that might be quite ruthless, that might to get to where you are.
Yeah.
And those people tend to, by nature, completely neglect their own health. Because that seems to be they're so focused, rightly so, on career progression and running a business, which, as we know, is a stressful feat, managing huge teams. But to get there seems to be, you know, health is pushed further and further down their list of priorities. So if they're not going to care about their own health, why would they care about the health of individuals company-wide? Until, I've noticed a trend,
yes,
though, until you turn it into the monetary value or the financials. So until you say you're losing X amount per sick days, or, you know, whatever that looks like, that's when the ears will prick up and the attention will be brought. But it's unfortunate that we have to use that strategy, or we have to sort of let some people fall by, you know, suffer through burnout for it to raise the red flag on what's happening.
But equally, even sometimes that doesn't work. I totally agree, because they just go, well, we'll get a new person, maybe a younger model, right? You know, who's keen to, who's happy to suck it up. You know, when I left academia, I was a young mom to two young children. I'd worked there for 15 years. I'd never had one day off, like not one sick day in 15 years. And it got to the point where I was like, I loved my job. I loved what I was doing, publishing research, had this clinic, giving back, educating. It was all of what I loved about what I love about health and well-being. But I thought, you know, you're looked after, people care. But once you walk out, you sit, and I've seen this as a pattern, you take time off, you leave, you realize you're you know, none of us are irreplaceable. So the next person comes in. So even with all, you can kill yourself, you can push, but they might put money into it, but actually it's probably cheaper for them to just bring in the next person, even though you and I know for to pay someone sick leave to then pay the replacement, to that's all costs money, right? And none of that exists 7 years ago when I burnt out. It's become more, thankfully, people are getting that support. Yeah.
You mentioned about office culture, and I suppose I'm always very careful when I discuss this with clients, because only they know the politics or the perceived politics of their office. I think what's actually going on versus how we perceive a situation can sometimes be very, very different. But for those who, I don't think what we're saying here is everyone leave their job and go, and, you know, it's not realistic, it's not viable. But for those who are in a position where they feel they want to make a change, but the office culture is very fixed, what are the things that we can do on the individual level without rocking the boat too much, I think people feel, you know, they need to be available a lot of the time. That's certainly something I see. Their diaries have to be open to book calls at any given time. Because we're working remotely now, I know many of my ladies are juggling different time zones at any time. So they'll be working with teams across the world. How, on an individual level, or what strategies can we bring in to start to make this feel a little bit more manageable?
Yeah, and that's what we often have to do, because if we think about the analogy of the stress bucket, which I'm sure more and more people are familiar with, but just to briefly say, it's like we all carry around this bucket and the demands come in the top and it fills up. And one approach to stress management is we're obviously trying to stop the water from overflowing, which would be the, you know, this synonymous with burnout. Sometimes we cannot change the demands coming in. Now, I was in a privileged position where I could get signed off work, which I did eventually after a lot of persuasion, and get sick pay, full sick pay for 6 months. Now, that's what helped me to recover. But if you're in an organization who haven't got that, that's not going to happen, or you can't leave work. So what's the alternative? If you can't change the demands coming in at the top, we have to start putting holes in the bucket. And on an individual level, that's something we can control, because stress, what is it? Well, it's this perception that we can't cope. And often that comes from a perception that things are out of our control and uncertain. Now, we could look at what you could control. I would argue there are a lot of things people think they can't control at work. Maybe their meetings, maybe there's certain things that we could look at and rejig. But on an individual level, I would encourage people to start thinking about their body as a vessel, in a sense of energy in, energy out, and not in the traditional diet kind of way. So one of the simplest and most effective strategies I do with all of my clients is I ask them, and I do this in talks because it's a very easy thing. People instantly get it. So if they're listening in now, you can try it where you're sat or wherever you are. Think about your typical day and think about every single activity you do from the minute you wake up to the minute you go to sleep. And just mentally or with a physical piece of paper and a pen, write down things that you do. I mean, where you spend your time. You know, who's the first person to get your attention? When do you first put food in your mouth? When do you sit still? When do you move? When do you go in nature? When do you get daylight? Just think about that for a minute. And once you've kind of mapped that out, we're all creatures of habit, generally speaking. Very, very rarely does things change. We have this kind of typical pattern of routine. The next thing to do is to think about, for each of those activities, color code them into green if they're bringing energy into you and restoring you and helping you to feel good. And I would add to that, that could be working, because we have this perception that work is always stressful. It's not. And I know this for a fact, because when I'm working on a project and I'm in focus time or I'm with a client, I'm relaxed, I'm in restoration. How do I know that? Because I track heart rate variability constantly. I'm that scientific nerd. And I can see when I'm working is the least stressful time of my day. When I'm with my two kids and the barking dog and dealing with traffic, that's a different picture, right? So map it out. Where do you feel like you're getting energy back? And where do you feel like you're giving all your energy out? Where is it taking? And that would be red. Have a look at your day. Is it, we would want a 50-50 split. No one's going to have all green unless we're a monk sitting on the side of a mountain, which would be bliss. But even they'd get bored, right? So we want some red, because don't forget, red just means you're giving energy away, but you might get, you might sign a contract off the back of that. You might organize a holiday. There's lots to be positive about a challenge. But if it's all red or mostly red, then that's something to start thinking about. So that's the first thing people should do, a little time audit. And then after that, we have to start thinking about energy in. How can I start to bring energy back in? Because if you think about, remember we talked about the body being this physiological response to demand, it's all about energy. So if we're giving the body energy, cortisol doesn't have to work as hard. So we're talking about energy from food. We're also talking about energy from people. We're talking about energy from spirituality. We're talking about energy from sleep, from rest, recovery. Does it need an hour? 10 minutes between meetings to yourself to take a breath. It could be that you sit in your car before you rush out to get to that next appointment. Small moments of putting green into your day and start with that. Before you know it, you created a stress buffer. What do I mean? The water levels come down just enough so you can tolerate the rest of the other stress. And the more we're consistent with that, the more likely we are to create a buffer. So demands will come in and the water level will go up again. we can't really always control that, but again, we can come back. So it puts the control back in our hands, regardless of what happens outside of ourselves. And it's really intuitive. People get it really quickly, but it can be really impactful. I take the pressure off having to do something big or grandiose, like a huge lifestyle change. Don't get me wrong, we can do that. All that stuff really, really works. But if you're in the stuck in the mud right now and you're really struggling, just start with that, and then we apply a routine. Maybe it's breath work that works for you. Maybe it's exercise. Everyone's different. We can fine-tune it, but just start with that to begin with.
This goes so nicely. We do an exercise with our clients called the Design Your Day exercise. And it's really about, we all have routines, but sometimes we don't feel that they're actually in place. And it's not until you commit them to paper or commit them to some form of diary that we can actually see, do you know what? I can run my day and I feel much more in command of it now that I can see what my day, a great day for me, would actually look like. And that's not always, working less. Some people really, really thrive on work. I think I always feel slightly guilty because this is a part of what we get to do as work. And this will be a conversation, Bernadette, that would bump my energy up. This would be a green for me. This would give me energy. So sometimes I feel slightly guilty about some of the things that we get to do, but equally, there are certain tasks that I love to do from in a work context that will give, and others that I know are definitely reds, and I'll be very, very careful about where I place them in the day because I know I might need a green and a green because of this red that's going to be in the middle. And I think one of the common misconceptions around this is that exercise is a red. So exercise is a taker. Whereas actually, if you've ever finished a workout, particularly one that you really didn't want to do, those ones that you really have to gear yourself up for, you maybe procrastinate a little bit before you go, and then you finish that bit of movement, you think, oh my God, I'm particularly pleased I finished that. I'm really happy that I got that done. I think a lot of our ladies will be able to relate to that.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point to raise, actually. I've worked with ASICS a few years ago on a project called Movement for Mind, looking at the benefit of movement in employees who are burnt out. And being a sports scientist, having that background, I'm fascinated by that research. And you're right, what we now know. Okay, so it's the first caveat to say is we need more research, because we don't have actually research investigating the impact of exercise on the type of clients that may be listening that I work with, definitely. So if you look at the sample sizes of the population, well, women tend to be overlooked, no surprise, the research. But also within that, they're often not maybe as stressed or burnt out. They will meet the criteria for burnout on a diagnostic questionnaire, but rarely do they measure the physical symptoms we talked about earlier, right? So how do we know from a physical point of view how stressed and burnt out someone is? And so when they do the research, the interventions they will do, we like, it's wide and varied, but 30-minute, let's say, aerobic exercise or some HIIT training. And it's often measured subjectively, so subjective measure of exercise on burnout or stress. And lo and behold, yeah, people will feel better. And we know that because of the way the chemicals change in our brain from movement. So absolutely 100% is evidence that as little as 15 minutes of movement is enough to help us to manage stress. Now, here's the bit where I question it. That's not what people are doing. They're either doing nothing, okay, or they're doing, here I am, ultramarathon lady. I've got people who are, high up in their organizations. They're going, Bernie, I'm really stressed, but I've entered an ultramarathon, or I'm really stressed and I'm going to do a marathon because I need to get fit. And I'm like, how are you? So training is a stressor. So if we add a training stress to life stress, where's the recovery? Where's the room for it? So it's less about, we have to use our words carefully, and when we're prescribing and looking at it, I'm very much of the case where we go, have you got capacity to absorb that? If it's training, i.e. a training program or training plan, or even doing a HIIT class, right, or a spinning class, if you're broken, on your knees, burnt out, overwhelmed, emotionally you might feel better, but actually that training exhaustion, that stress on the body, could push you further into overtraining and burnout. So it might be that you just need a walk with your dog or in nature, or yoga, Pilates, stretching. Strength training, especially in females, we need to lift weights, we need to move stuff. So I would just, again, it's just because of my thing with it is I love to exercise and move, but I often see a big mistake people make is they get that slightly wrong. And I'm not here to point fingers, because I did too. I was completely like, we have all the research, running and exercise, it improves our mental health, so do all the running. And I got it wrong because I burnt out. And I see it time and time again. And it's not a criticism. It's just, I think in the marketing and the messaging, we have to help people, women, who are adding that to an already struggling system, for sure.
There is something that I wanted to ask you. You touched on it already. Are you wearing an Oura ring?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I track. I've been tracking heart rate variability for about 6 years, 7 years.
Way before it became trendy. We've literally just, the recording before this is around what I track with my clients predominantly. And I'm sure you will, you'll agree with me. The advances and accessibility of the technology that we now have is incredible. You're an Oura wearer. I use Whoop myself, but we are now privy to so much technology. A lot of my clients will use them. How do we measure stress via our trackers? And you mentioned heart rate variability there. I wonder if you could explain a little bit about what it is, what impacts it, and how you use it to.
It's a powerful metric. So let's start with what it is for anyone who might not know. So heart rate variability is exactly as it describes. It's variation in heart rate. Now, if we think about it, most of us understand the concept of resting heart rate, and a lower the resting heart rate, the fitter we are, or maybe the more healthy we are. And most people should have a resting heart rate of around 70 beats per minute. So let's say we take, for example, somebody who had a resting heart rate and they're quite fit and healthy and it's 60 beats per minute. We could assume that their heartbeat is every second, because we're human beings and they say, well, 60 beats per minute and there must be like every second. But that's not how the human body works. It's a very fluid thing. And what happens is some beats between, there might be the gap between beats might be 0.8 of a second, or it might be 1.2 of a second, or it might be 1.5 or 0.6. And there's always variation between heartbeats. Now, we want variation. Think about a tennis player. This is the example I always give, right? So if you've got a tennis player and they're flat-footed at the baseline, ready to receive a serve, they're not going to do so well. They're always on their toes, reactive, responsive to deal with whatever happens. The body is the same. So we want variation between heartbeats. We don't want beats to be monotone. We don't want them to be stuck on the second. So we want lots of heart rate variability. The fitter, the healthier you are, the less stressed you are, the higher your heart rate variability. So high heart rate variability is good. So it's against what we might think, right? High heart rate variability, you are good. Low heart rate variability means we have got some demand on the system, stress on the system. So with tracking heart rate variability, it's synonymous with what's going on in our nervous system. So if somebody's got a low heart rate variability, it indicates a stress within the body. So they will be having lots of sympathetic nervous system activity, meaning that they're in, to use the term, fight or flight more often than they are in rest and digest, which is the parasympathetic. So trackers such as Oura Ring, Whoop Band, I use different devices with my clients. First is called First Beat Technology, which is a lifestyle fitness, which is an assessment. So they wear it on the chest and it's like a portable ECG machine. Or you've got another one I've been using forever is called HRV4 training, which is one that's on a phone, which is an app, and it's really good to help with training. It doesn't matter what metric you use, except to say some are more valid and reliable than others. So do your research. Fundamentally, it's powerful because it allows, you know, we just talked about the reds and the greens. It does it for you. So you can see at a glance what part of your day you were in stress, what part of your day you were in recovery and rest. The power of it from an educational point of view for me is key, because it helps people to see the nuances where they may have thought they were stressed and actually they weren't, or they may have thought they were resting and actually they were stressed. So that's powerful, because rather than me setting them a 10-step plan to managing stress and we all go on the same journey together, we can use that data to kind of tailor interventions. So if anyone listening, if they're You don't have to do this. You could do the very rudimentary, like you say, plan your day, or I use a time audit. You can do that yourself. But if you want objective data, then I would say it's worth the investment. And like I said, there's different price ranges of what you invest in or what you can do.
It's really, really interesting. I mean, for me personally, when I started to track my HRV, it totally changed my relationship with alcohol.
Wow, how
Because
so?
I hated the waking up the next day. I could be HRV high in the sky, high, 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 and it would absolutely plummet the next day after alcohol. Alcohol, the poor night's sleep, the combination. And it really made me go, do you know what? I don't like seeing that on my Aura data. I'm going to change that behavior. I'm going to change what I do. And it was because of that specific metric, as one. But I'm going to ask the question because someone asked me this last week. Is there a minimum? And I've realized that it's very, very personal, but is there a minimum HRV score that you would suggest people are aiming for?
No, it is individual. So the idea with tracking is you learn the device or whatever you use will look at your baseline. So, you know, there are norms for the population, males and females. But again, we're still learning research, we're still learning. Those norms are only off the back of the data that's collected by that, you know, by science, by research. So it's you know, the sample size relative to the human population is quite small. The key with their heart rate variability is less to worry about what your score is, but to look at how it's either improving or decreasing. So it's looking at patterns of change over time. You know, at the minute, for example, and again, they use different ways of measuring it. So one app I use, Heart Rate for Training, will score it, say a single score, say, oh, you know, it's normalized data out of 10. But you don't get a score like that. You get a different score would say Aura or Whoop, so they translate it into easy to read kind of language. Now, the only thing I will say with the devices is, and this is off the back of lots of reading I've done, I'm standing on the shoulders of giants here. It's not me saying this. A great guy called Marco Altini, who's a developer of one of the apps, he's a real heart rate variability kind of thought leader and scientist. He's published lots of research. His main advice when it comes to these devices is to stick to the objective measures. What does that mean? Actual heart rate measure. There'll be lots of other cool scores, such as your restoration, your readiness for the day. Most of the time, that's off the back of what you put in. So whether you know if you self-report you slept or how well the sleep tracker, how well the device is tracking your sleep. So all that's great and it's really sexy and it looks really cool in the marketing and it's all this extra data. But really, we just need to know how's your heart rate variability doing, and like you did, adjust your lifestyle around that. To get the best out of yourself.
Yeah, and I would parrot that and say the trends over time is what we always look at. So looking at you versus you and your baseline scores and how things are trending, rather than getting too caught up in anyone else's scores or
It's
finding
irrelevant.
yeah,
Yeah.
amazing. Barney, thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure. I will actually ask you before I stop, any reason you went for Aura instead of any other platform?
It's a really good question. So because I'm basically researching it, I'm trialing it, I'm being a bit of a nerd. I wanted to see it's an investment from a point of view before we roll it out with our clients, you know, which is the best product. Some people will want that. It's a high-end, really expensive relative to other ones. And I wanted to see what they are providing for that, what is the data behind it. We're also trialing Whoop as well, so we're going to do a comparison. Because again, another app I use, it's only £10 and I've used that for 7 years. So I'm kind of like, well, is it any better? And what's the correlation between the ones I use? And the ones I use with my clients are they're more kind of a scientific level one. So that's first beat technology, which isn't something that somebody would wear 24/7 like a device. It's a one-off assessment like you would. They do it for 3 to 5 days. We get so much data from it, and then we put an intervention in place and we repeat the measure again. So from a knowledge transfer point of view, from an education point of view, that works really well. And also, I would argue, I just needed to know that, you know, how it's communicating this to people. Because if I'm working with clients with Aura and Whoop and this and that, there's other ones out there some of my clients use that I haven't heard of. And it's important that I think as a practitioner in that field, I have a feel for what they're working with and what might be the best. And from I have to admit, as a skeptic, not a skeptic, but as a hard kind of customer to convince. I am incredibly impressed with Aura. I think it's great. I think there's lots of stuff you don't need, but the reliability and the output, I think, is pretty accurate and pretty impressive. Yeah.
We're now partnered with Aura Teams, and I have to say their dashboard is phenomenal.
Yeah, that's the next move
Really.
is for me, actually. That's interesting you say that, because I've been in touch with them and I was like, let me get, I want to know first.
But I will say the difference is actually testing the products changes your perception. I do like Whoop, and I will say the sole reason that I wear Whoop is because it's a wristband rather than a ring.
Exactly.
That's it. That is literally, and it's just personal preference. I love the platform. I think Aura is phenomenal. My partner uses it religiously, finds no issue wearing the ring. For me, I just prefer the wristband, and that's all it came down to. So
I
if
can
anyone
see
is
that.
out there, and like anything, I have to sit on the fence with quite a lot, and I think the
Same.
nuance and the context is so, so key. So I don't preach any one over the other. It has to fit you, your lifestyle, budget, and what you actually need it to. Because for some people, I know the level of data can be hugely overwhelming, and it's
Exactly.
necessary. If it's going
Yeah.
to distract you from your goals, then it's redundant. And if anything, it's going to negatively impact progress long term. So it's so,
Yeah.
so important that you find the right fit.
I would 100% agree. And I'll just add to that, actually, in some people, I advise them not to track. There is certain personality traits, types, tracking, whether it's food or HRV, can become obsessive and actually detrimental to their stress and mental health. So if that's you and you think it could become an obsessive thing, we can use pen and paper. We can use subjective measures. It's all effective, So yeah, there's ways around it.
I've had women improve their sleep subjectively, but have improved their sleep but via pen and paper next to the next to
Exactly.
bed taking notes. It's awareness, it's observation, and actioning, actually executing those interventions and those changes. So I'm really,
100%.
really pleased to hear we're on the same page there.
Yeah,
I'll ask
absolutely.
again, if anyone has listened to today's recording, has really loved what you've brought to this episode, which is a ton of value, and they want to find out a little bit more about the work that you do, where are the best places to find you, and what do you have coming up?
Yeah, so my personal website is my name, bernadettedancy.co.uk. You can find me on Instagram, where I mostly kind of hang out. It's Bernadette Dancy Stress Coach. And the work that I'm building at the minute is a really exciting project. So developing a business called Stress Ed, which is basically a stress education platform business to go that one step further, to rather than just coach, which is a big part of it, we want to really educate and empower people to be the kind of thought leaders and the educational leaders for stress, the science and psychology. So translate all that really nerdy, boring science into really practical courses, webinars with experts like yourself and other people who are at the front end doing this work, so we can bring it out and be that trusted place to go to for that. So that's really exciting, and it's part of what we're doing. And you can find us at www.stress-ed.co.uk.
I'm going to link everything in the show notes below. But thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Really,
We could
really
talk all day. Thank
and
you.
Thank you for coming on the podcast.
I want to say a huge thanks to Bernadette for joining me on the podcast and gifting me all of that wonderful energy. I hope you got a bit of that green light energy just from listening to the podcast. It was a joy to have her on, so much value, and I'm just thrilled that we got a chance to dive into one of the biggest topics. We're all dealing with stress, whatever that looks like in your lifestyle. We all have stressors in our life. And one of the things that I stepped away from this episode really confident about actually was Bernadette's stance on, it's always going to happen. We're always going to have this stress coming in. It's how we have those pockets of time throughout our day that allow us to top up and become more resilient in what is a very, very stressful lifestyle for many of us. Okay. If you enjoyed this episode of the podcast, if you've been listening for a while, perhaps this was your first time, but if you've taken any golden nuggets of information from any episode that you have listened to, if you could show your support for the show, I would be eternally, eternally grateful. There are two ways to do that. The first one, simply hit the follow or subscribe button on your chosen podcast platform. You're probably listening to me on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or send to someone in your inner circle. Perhaps you've met a friend for coffee, or you've got a colleague or a family member who is going through a particularly tough time. Perhaps they've expressed to you that they're feeling a little bit stressed, frazzled, anxious, overwhelmed at the moment. Send them the show or this episode of the podcast. Hopefully we can help them in the same way that we may have been able to help you up until this point. Okay, and last from me this week, if you would love to make a positive change to your health and well-being, perhaps you would love to make changes to your diet, perhaps you would love to consistently exercise, perhaps you are struggling with perimenopause and menopausal symptoms at the moment, and you're interested in finding out more about one-to-one coaching, get in touch. My details are in the show notes below. Jump on a 15-minute discovery call. Let's have a chat, find out more about you and your lifestyle, but crucially, where you want to go. Where do you want to be going into Q2 of 2024? I'd love to find out more. Okay, have a fantastic rest of your week, and we'll see you next week on the Health Hacks Podcast.